Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Matthew Witt. Matt is full professor of public administration at Laverne University in California. Matt, congratulations on the promotion. It couldn't happen to a more well-deserved individual. Strong academic, strong views on the right side of history, as I like to say. Matt, it's great having you back on the program. A belated congratulations.
Well, thank you, Stephen. It's wonderful to be back on the program.
Oh, it's great having you back on. There's always so much going on. I've been writing about so many issues. What specifically is on your mind? This morning I wrote an article, I just finished it, on the situation, on the cop in New York who got away with killing a man in Staten Island. And, of course, the Ferguson issue is still resonating, plus all of the other issues going on globally. Let's jump into one of these. I'll let you pick an issue that you want to discuss first, then we can go to others.
I think we're on the same page, Stephen, and I'd like with you, as we are able to, you know, sort of knit the connections between what we see happening domestically in the United States and what's happening globally, because I think there's an awful lot of symmetry to the militarization we see of our own society and what we are doing around the globe.
Matt, I think that's the key point. I think that really is the key point. I mean, we have a militarized military, a rotten way of explaining it, rampaging around the world, and we militarize our state and local police forces with combat weapons. When are we going to see tanks on the street where you are, Matt, in Chicago, in New York, in any U.S. city? I think it's just a matter of time before we see this.
Well, we have the armored vehicles, the MRAPs,
in Ferguson,
on streets across. Well, and these are across the country, and they have been now for some time. So the appearance of a kind of occupation is emerging. And I'm not sure now who I gleaned this from, but I thought it was a remarkable insight. It might have been from Radley Balko's work on police militarization. But while we see the militarization of domestic law enforcement, we see the policification of our military occupations, so that there's becoming a kind of seamless correspondence between, you know, all of our presence of authority, of armed authority around the globe, in our cities, in our most vulnerable communities, is an armed military occupation. It's redundant to say armed, I guess, but it's with the intention of pacifying whomever is deemed right to threaten the order. I teach police quite a bit. Local police, Stephen, are in our program, both at the master's level and doctoral level. And, you know, you tend to get kind of dichotomous outlook. On the one hand, you get the standard kind of defensive, evasive, sometimes even dissembling sort of response to the evidence, scholarly and otherwise, of this trend and what it may portend. And that's, you know, that can really undermine a discussion in class, because so often police are deferred to or demurred towards by other students. There's this kind of adulation for law enforcement because we have so much of it on television, I think. So much of it is glamorized. And there's this sense that they know more than anyone else about, you know, sort of real problems and how real problems have to be dealt with. And this sort of, you know, not so ethically developed outlook that law and order requires sometimes, you know, brute force, and that brute force, to the extent it maintains order, is for the good of society. So it's these sort of very simplistic platitudes and syllogisms that, as a professor, of course, it's my job to challenge and disrupt. You'd think maybe people coming into a master's level program would be more inclined, but so often it's the case that while they may be plenty bright, there becomes this sort of paralysis of discussion when law enforcement's in the room. On the other hand, there are those law enforcement personnel that we get that are quite philosophical. And in many instances, they've moved up the chain of command and or out of the agency where they may have worked and take on a different perspective, and could be quite useful for helping to delve into some of these issues. But anyway, I don't want to drift off there. But it's just, you know, the environments where we try to be, where we're supposed to be discursive and, you know, rational, and we're supposed to canvas the facts, and we're supposed to, you know, interpolate from those facts into probable scenarios and possible better outcomes or solutions or changes, maybe, we so often end up with kind of regressive discussions or defensive positions or failure to read the material faithfully. Anyway, I sound like any old professor at that point. A lot of ways I am. But what we have, to get back to your points, we have the emergence of clear outlines of a specter of militarized law enforcement in the United States and constant military/police occupation increasingly across the globe. And under the most dubious and specious claims of fact and rationale, as with, you know, your great work on Ukraine circumstances. I hope we get back to the Ukrainian issues. I think it's worth touching on those, you know, to regularly.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And we have a whole hour. We can touch on lots of things.
Sure. The officer in the chokehold instance, so remarkable when you see the footage. I was in a black student union at the University of Laverne, and I'm not joking when I say it's the best, most intellectual, most informed, insightful, dare I say, adult discussion you will find anywhere on campus. And I include their faculty meetings, you know, senior management task forces. You will not find a more sort of sobering, you know, intellectual discussion than at the Black Student Union. And I suspect that this is the case at so many campuses. And why I say that is because they take on real issues that affect them existentially. And they have no choice but to wrestle with the facts. And I am just so impressed by our young people doing so at the University of Laverne. Not a plug for my university. It's just an observation of that particular discussion. So yesterday, we were talking, and, you know, in a kind of forum about, you know, Ferguson and Staten Island and what all of this portends. And there came up the question of the call for body cameras of the police and a very astute student said, well, there was a camera running constantly on the instance in Staten Island, and yet they murdered the man. You know, they had four or five police officers take, I don't remember his name right now. I'm basing his name.
Yeah, his last name is Garner.
Taking him down, you can see it's right on camera. The man was killed on camera. And so what difference did a camera make? Besides that, you know, we have reports here in my own, where I work, at the city of Luverne, where the police department has said, at least on one occasion, it's in response to requests, where are your body cameras? Oh, they're not operational. And this is, I imagine this has come up more than once. They're not operational. Police can do whatever they want with that type of evidence. That type of evidence can very conveniently be made non-operational. So this call for body cameras is indicative, I think, of a chronic unwillingness, a kind of pathological syndrome in American culture and society, unable to face, own up to this ongoing tyranny against people of color, particularly young people, young men and young black men. It's just this, because to do so, you know, is to surface, bring to the surface the bitter contradictions at the core of our social contract, and also call into question the legitimacy of the monopoly use of violence. As with these grand jury mock trials. So you had, in the case of the Michael Brown shooting, you know, there's no way we were going to see an indictment of the police officer, because to do so would be to call into question that authority, which, in a sense, cannot be questioned. I mean, it should be, but at a kind of ontological level, it cannot be, because at the core of any state is the monopoly control of violence. When you start questioning that, you start to unravel so many claims of legitimacy. And that may benefit from this or that task force, that may benefit from this or that, you know, legislative subcommittee. That sort of dilemma may be something that over time can be, you know, addressed. Yeah, sure. We had civil rights culminating with very important legislation in the early 1960s. And we had further legislation, not nearly so momentous, but some of it very important. Yes, this is true. Yet, why do we see such regressive tendencies nonetheless?
Matt, if I could make a couple of points.
Please do.
On the one hand, of course, the video evidence in the killing of Eric Garner in Staten Island, it didn't come from a police camera. It came from a private individual on the scene recording it on a cell phone.
Absolutely.
Whole thing, including waiting 7 minutes after apparently Garner was dead to apply CPR, and of course it was too late, and when they got him to a hospital, he was pronounced dead. Another very important point, a couple of Supreme Court decisions. I wrote an article this morning. I finished it a little bit earlier. I titled it Killer Cops, It's on my blog site. A couple of Supreme Court decisions going back to the 1980s. On the one hand, coming down against this sort of police violence, but on the other hand, providing wiggle room for cops to get away with it using a legalistic language, Matt. An expression was used, where is it in my article? I think two different phrases. One of them was objectively reasonable circumstances. Cops can do the kind of things that they did in Staten Island and in Ferguson, Missouri. Well, with that kind of an insertion into a Supreme Court ruling, I mean, basically the cops can say anything. We were being threatened, so we had no choice. You know, the standard police response when they get called down for the violence they commit, whether it's beating up on people, whether it's killing them or injuring them or whatever, if they can just say we were being threatened, according to these Supreme Court decisions, I believe two of them, they can get away with murder and they take full advantage of it. So what it really means is there's no way in the world that you're going to see cops indicted for committing murder.
Objectively reasonable circumstances fragments reality into it parts as reality into rubble, those sorts of semantic maneuvers. Right. So by way of example, you would have the testimony of the police officer of the Michael Brown murder. Insist that he felt was set upon by a demon, or the worst, a demonic presence that overtaken this 18-year-old, not even 18, not sure how old, like he was a youth, right? And so, little by little, the victim is put on trial. The victim was possessed. The victim assaulted. This is true. The victim did assault the officer while he was in his squad car, and the officer's weapon was sidearm was discharged, but were there not to be any cross examination of the police officer, well, what do you mean? Have you ever, how long have you been a police officer? How many instances of engagement with others would you characterize as demonic? You know, a cross-examination would bring to the surface the fraud at the center of these claims. You know, the dubiousness, so that But of course, we're not going to have that. I mean, it's one thing for the Supreme Court to establish this, to wordsmith and finesse semantically the authority of police that establishes basically they can do whatever they want, whenever they want. That's one thing. But it's another thing for instances of murder not to go to trial. That's an altogether different matter. And because it's at trial where you can cross-examine, if in fact objective circumstances that others would consider life-threatening to the police officer or others warranted use of deadly force. In the case of the chokehold, the victim was subdued completely. You can see the handcuffs dangling from either, let's go back and look at the tape, either from the victim himself or from one of the officers while the chokehold's being administered. Why weren't the handcuffs placed on the victim before he was killed? That's all that had to happen.
Right.
To the extent he had to be abducted, or he had to be assaulted by police at all. He was selling cigarettes on the street. That's what he was doing. I don't think that's not a contested fact.
And there were the handcuffs. And I don't, this Supreme Court case you mentioned, do you recall when it came out?
There were two cases, Matt, that go back to the 1980s, and I don't have them in front of me. But basically, again, really double standard. On the one hand, deploring this kind of police violence and basically outlawing it, except under these special circumstances where cops can take advantage, like saying we were being threatened, so we had to defend ourselves. And, of course, that's what cops say all the time. It doesn't matter. I mean, somebody could be unarmed. They can literally have nothing in their hands, nothing threatening in any way, and yet cops can claim they're being threatened. They can even plant a weapon by the victim, which is what they did with Mumia Abu-Jamal in Philadelphia about 30 years ago or so now, back in the 1980s, where he had nothing to do with killing a policeman in Philadelphia, but they planted a gun claiming it was his. It's been a long time since I've written about him, and the details I don't have in front of me, but he was framed. He didn't do anything. He didn't kill anybody, and he's been in prison for 30 years. He'll probably never get out, but he's a high-profile case. There are many, many others, usually nameless, faceless people, blacks and Latinos. These are the ones that are affected by these kind of things, and it really shows, Matt, that America is a police state. It can be as vicious as the most vicious police states anywhere in the world.
You know, we have just recently the UN, however, ceremonial has been this inquiry into a violation of human rights by the United States. This is in the news now that Democracy Now has been giving this a fair amount of play, synced up with, coverage of Ferguson related stories. There was a comment made. It came in one of these news accounts. Observation of the U.S. How is it that the U.S. can parade its authority around the globe when its integrity is so dubious in matters of race at home? In matters in this sort of bizarre, to most of the world, even Anglo parts of the world, I think even for the British, our hysteria around race gives pause, even to the British, even to the Dutch, even to those powers that have been so monstrous in their subjugation of and classification of people according to specious pseudoscience categories. So we are in the grip of a syndrome in this country. I think it's a mass kind of I'm not a clinician, but I wish more clinicians would take account of this. We need a gestalt shift in this country. We need to stop blaming the victim. This is very much what happens again in the default level of intellectual discourse in higher education. At least I think almost overwhelmingly, the default presumption is that the victim is to blame wherever there can be claimed disruption of social order. The victim is to blame. Those protesters, they were asking for it when they, caused property damage. They were asking for it. And never mind the extent to which police played the dirtiest tricks on protest events where they provoke disruptions. They slip in and out undercover to throw punches that then authorizes uniformed police to come in and move in with phalanx in phalanx order on crowds. This happens over and over and over again. Otherwise, peaceful protests are reined in, assaulted, really, by police phalanx on the instigation of the police themselves.
Matt, I can remember, this goes back a little bit, around the time of the 2003 Iraq War, when there actually was some anti-war protests going on. We certainly don't see any of that now. But there was one in Chicago, and that I remember very distinctly, and where it began and where it was going, I'm not sure. But I remember looking out of my window and seeing phalanxes of Chicago cops on horseback, side by side. I mean, just literally side by side. I said, what are these cops going to do? Are they going to charge these people, doing absolutely nothing? As I remember, I think a write-up about what was to take place, the protest to take place, was that people would assemble at a certain point and then march peacefully to another point, where other people would make comments, give talks, brief talks, and I think this was the plan of the day, a platform being set up with a microphone and so on, so people would march maybe a half a mile or a mile to where they were going, and here I saw cops, I mean really aggressive looking cops lined up on horseback, and it scared me, wondering, are these cops going to charge these people and literally trample them? I don't remember exactly what happened, and I don't think the cops did charge the marches, but it was a very serious situation that could have developed that way. If one of the marches or a few of them did anything the cops didn't like, they could have responded in the most violent way, and there could have been deaths.
That's right. And again, getting back to those Supreme Court decisions you mentioned, those assaults would be done essentially with impunity. And again, because the fix is in with the structure of the grand jury, the convening of the grand jury by district attorney. The district attorneys who work hand in glove with police departments are somehow presumed neutral when it comes to police misconduct. It's a preposterously corrupt judicial process.
Matt, I wrote about
that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just a brief comment. I wrote about the grand jury process in an article I wrote maybe a week, 10 days ago. The fact that the article was titled Systemic Injustice in America. I wanted to talk about Ferguson, but I wanted to make it a greater issue because Ferguson is just a microcosm. This stuff goes on across America, and rarely do you get headlines like you get in the Ferguson situation and the headlines we're now getting on the Staten Island killing. You get it occasionally that there was a Cleveland killing just a number of days ago, a young 12-year-old boy with a toy gun, gunned down by police, and the first thought of my mind was that, my God, as a young boy growing up, I had a toy gun. It was a cap pistol. You put these caps in it, and you pull the trigger, and it had I guess it had gunpowder in the caps, and some of them didn't go off, but they would go off making a sound to simulate gunfire going off. But a lot of kids played with guns like that. I might have been 10 or 11 or 12 years old, and I mean, no cops ever charged me or anybody else in my neighborhood, a mixed neighborhood, but we see this stuff going on. The grand jury, Matt. The grand jury is controlled by the prosecutor. The prosecutor can either rig it, can pick who will sit on the grand jury, the number of people to sit on it. The system can be rigged either to exonerate a cop or indict somebody that the city or state wants to convict. So the grand jury says it's really a horrible system, Matt. The grand jury system shouldn't exist because the fact that it's controlled by the prosecutors makes it a corrupt system to come out exactly the way they want it to. There's no justice from the grand jury.
In the case of that 12-year-old dude, there was, again, you know, the police testimony was that there was an assumption he was much older than he actually was. Now, in the case of the Michael Brown shooting, there was the testimony by the police officer, Darren Wilson, that he he thought he was, you know, Brown possessed a superhuman strength, a demonic, you know, proportion. There's a bias that psychologists are pinpointing in this instance that has been called superhumanization. And it's particularly, it is explanatory of, you know, this tendency to attribute to people of color, particularly black, young black men, you know, this superhuman, explosive temperament with strength that is Hulk-like, right? And again, this is indicative of the Ferguson testimony, in the testimony of the grand jury testimony of Darren Wilson. It's indicative of the testimony of the officers who shot the 12-year-old boy, who was doing exactly what the military state wishes him to do, start playing with guns early and keep playing with them. That boy was doing exactly what is expected, and he was shot dead for it in some kind of macabre irony. But this bias, to me, again, Stephen, is indicative of a deep, deep sickness at the core of this country's consciousness. You know, that police officers, sworn to protect and serve the people, can behave this way and make claim that these false attributions are somehow warrant for, you know, acts of profound cowardice. I mean, I think that that's really, in some ways, we've got what we have to call this conduct, because this gets right to the heart of why police, of attributions made about police being courageous. These are not acts of remotely, these are acts of profound cowardice. Cowardice in the sense that we're talking about a 12-year-old kid. We're talking about, you know, it's either in the case of Michael Brown, I mean, really, you're a police officer. You shoot him dead at a distance where you could have, you didn't have to shoot him dead. There, it wasn't such a distance that you couldn't, with minimal marksmanship, disable him without killing him. You know, in the case of the 12-year-old youth, there's just nothing other than reprehensible to describe the conduct of those police officers. I don't think, in the case of the chokehold, reprehensible. You know, it's either assault with intent to kill, or it is a kind of the worst kind of cowardice, which is a bully with a gun. And I struggle a lot as a educator with public administration, with the program, you know, with what I teach, the topics I teach, with how to get at this issue. So I you know, what I have to do is I have to talk about it in structural terms. But at some level, what we do is law enforcement becomes a refuge in this country for some of the worst criminals we have, some of the most pathological people we have. They don't get weeded out. And a culture that is already predisposed to shoot first mentality, and increasingly authorized to do so, is really becoming a lethal, it's such a toxic sort of, representation of our worst failures and weaknesses.
I agree with you. It doesn't mean that all cops are bad. All cops are not all bad. But the police or law enforcement or security, these type of occupations, they really are refuges. refuses for people who are inherently violent because they know they can literally get away with murder. I think maybe they understand this. You pin a badge on somebody, whether it's a cop, whether it's an FBI agent, whether it's another federal enforcer, maybe a border patrol guard or a security guard in a building armed with a gun, and they know that they can claim anything. You know, we were being threatened again, and they can literally get away with murder. So maybe it attracts this kind of mentality where some people just may go in that direction to let out their hostility freely on anybody that they want to do it, and it's usually a person of color. The police violence takes place in minority communities. You don't see them taking place in, say, a middle-class white community. It would be a great, great exception if anything like that happens, but it's in the minority communities where you see these things. Blacks and Latinos are the victims.
Absolutely, and this is not, you know, these are by civil servants sworn to protect and serve the public. And in fact, what's going on is something very different. The police, social workers, teachers, we are what is described by a sociologist, Michael Lipsky, many years ago, as street-level bureaucrats. And our jobs are to deal with people, fundamentally, with people, often not at their best. And we become this front line for the enforcement of society's norms and laws. And for that matter, and so often, as with the constant assault on our educational institutions for failing to perform for the best interests of students, this constant attack on teachers and teacher unions, this sort of withering BS rhetoric from the 24-hour news cycle pundits, that just keeps harping on the bad bureaucrat. All of this is smoke and mirrors for a failure that occurs long before a police pulls his gun, long before a social worker has to contend with all sorts of contradictions in the service provisions to people who need them, long before a teacher tries to address these wickedly complex, layered problems, long before that happens, a kind of fix is in, and that's where the Supreme Court comes in, and that's where other agencies come in. Getting back to the militarization trend, at the opening of his Chapter 6 of the book titled Rise of the Warrior Cop by Radley Balco, he says, it's very brief here, he says, William French Smith set the tone for the Reagan administration early on. In one of the first cabinet meetings, the new attorney general declared, quote, the Justice Department is not a domestic agency. It is the internal arm of the national defense. This is the chief officer of the court of the land blurring this distinction, 35 years ago. Between these entities, exactly what we opened our discussion with, that there is this convergence or isomorphism between law enforcement domestically on the one hand and police and military occupation elsewhere on the other hand, and then there's just this. Ralph does a very quite diligent job of establishing the establishing the contours of this trend over the ensuing decades, and culminating with, you know, as with others doing this, a very useful explanatory framework for why Ferguson happened, for why Staten Island happened, for why a 12-year-old kid could be shot dead with no instigation whatsoever, none. And that's, I mean, it's just startling. The Justice Department is not a domestic agency. It is the internal arm of the national defense. I don't think there's any way we can say this was taken out of context. That language is so explicit. Internal arm of the national defense. That says in no uncertain terms what the perspective was going to be from the Attorney General. So,
well, indeed, yeah. Matt, cops in America have always served wealth and power against the interests of ordinary people, especially minority people or America's most disadvantaged poor people and so on. And only in more recent years, with the militarization of state and local police across the country nationwide, and I believe the number I used in one of my articles was something like 8,000 police forces across America take advantage of the militarization program, getting surplus Pentagon weaponry. I mean, heavy stuff. I mean, really heavy stuff. The weapons that America used in combat, giving it to local police forces to use against ordinary people on city streets. It really is outrageous. So as bad as it was years ago, it's so infinitely worse now because cops literally have weapons that can just wipe you out en masse.
Yes, right. And I think, in some ways more insidiously, what they do is establish a shock and awe presence. You know, sort of like, well, wait a minute. You know, people make attribution. You know, they see on the news that their community is under siege, and they see the cops militarized. And there's this very insidious false attribution process that goes on. You know, that rather than question, hey, how'd they become militarized, the question becomes, the presumption becomes, wow, something must be really wrong with my community that the police have to behave this way. You know, in the instance of what you're referring to, the surplus armament from the Defense Department. And in fact, the Defense Department surpluses are a relatively small proportion of the armaments that police agencies are acquiring. An awful lot of what they're acquiring is from grant monies provided them by the federal government to purchase from private vendors all sorts of high-tech stuff. And in the case of Obama's ceremonious convening a task force for this, you know, so-called community policing initiative, he made very clear that he would not, when sort of confronted with the question of the 1330 program and the other ways in which monies are and how grant funds are funneled to local law enforcement for purchases of high-tech weaponry, he said explicitly, we are not going to suspend those programs. Those programs are, you know, those are off the table. You know, we can talk about sort of all sorts of other things, but that particular program, you know, has become a sacred cow. Those grant funds and that 1330 has become a, is like a sacred cow.
It really is a sacred cow, man, and I think behind the project, which has been going on for a number of years, is the notion that the things have gotten so bad in America, including increasing oppression against millions and millions of people, that sooner or later there will be an uprising. It won't just be a protest or a few broken windows that may go on for a number of days or even a little longer than that, like what's going on in Ferguson. But we don't see we don't see mass killings in the streets. But sooner or later, there'll be an explosion, maybe unlike anything America ever saw before. So the authorities in Washington want to be sure that local police forces are armed with heavy weapons so they can come at these people and literally murder them en masse if they have to. And I think that's what's behind going on. Another comment I made in one of my articles on this, I talked about the initiative of wanting to make Ferguson look like Ukraine. Maybe that's a good segue into Ukraine, Matt, so we don't leave it out of the discussion today as we get to, in the last part of the program. I think it's important to discuss Ukraine. But, I mean, Ferguson was really looking like Ukraine with the violence extreme. You don't see artillery shelling buildings, but, I mean, that really might be the next step. Tanks in the streets, any kind of heavy weapons targeting people and murdering them in cold blood, and that's exactly what's going on in southeastern Ukraine with the help of America, or a phrase I use repeatedly, with full support and encouragement from Washington. So Washington supports this stuff abroad, supports it at home. It doesn't matter whether civilians are being murdered unjust. Any kind of murder is unjust, but this is what's going on. It's going on right now as we speak, Matt. It's a horrible situation in Ukraine, including challenging Russia, that literally could erupt into something very, very serious, a direct confrontation, a belligerent confrontation with Russia, where maybe Russia one day will decide we're simply not going to take this anymore and Russia and react. And I really wish in a small way that Russia would do that, because America, like any other bully, goes after targets that are easily handled, easily defeated, so you can defeat an Iraq. Haven't been able to defeat a Syria yet, because using proxy forces. But if America wanted to defeat Syria, it would be very easy to do it. Send in a lot of ground troops the way that was used in Iraq. The one exception is Afghanistan, although the Taliban initially were routed in October 2001. For a month or two, the Taliban were routed, but all they did was go back, regroup, come back, and now 13 years or so later, we've got almost 14 years later, I believe, the war is going on. It could go on for another 14 years, so that's an exception. Maybe there could be exceptions elsewhere, but if America wanted to use full force, certainly you could turn countries to rubble, which is exactly what has been done in the case of Syria, in the case of older wars, Vietnam, Korea, other conflicts, proxy wars with stuff that's been going on. So this is going on abroad, and the Ukraine situation could develop into something much more serious than what's going on in southeastern Ukraine. It literally could be a Russia versus U.S. situation with the literal threat of a war between Russia and America, possibly a global war. This is what concerns me the most.
It's ominous. As you pay diligent account, even through writing, blogging, programming, it's ominous. I think, you know, it's ominous and so depressing, the nefariousness, as with, you know, what actually happened with the occupiers burned in was it Donetsk? Right, the precipitating event that was a staging of neo-Nazis and a claim that the fire was started by the occupiers, when in fact what happened
was... You're talking, that was Odessa, the Odessa massacre?
I'm sorry, it was Odessa.
Odessa back in May. Oh, that was horrible.
Yeah.
And the official reports... talked about something like 48 people being burned to death in a government administrative building. Well, virtually nobody was burned to death. They were strangled. They were shot at close range. Women were raped. These right sector forces were in the building, and it wasn't 48 people or so who were killed. It was something like 400 people who took refuge in this government administration building, basically kind of directed into the building as a safe haven.
That's right.
But the right sector people, thugs, were in the building waiting for them, waiting to attract them. There was a fire in the building, but it was containable. It was only on a floor or two. And again, nobody was burned to death. I don't believe anybody was burned to death, shot, strangled, thrown out of windows. That's the way these people were killed.
And then there were, I'm not sure what the... I'm not sure exactly where these images originated, but it's no question that they're authentic, and I believe they've been authenticated. But there were images of corpses, hideous images, in that building, where they were doused with some kind of flammable agent and burned from the torso up.
Oh yeah. Exactly. Part of the body was burned, Matt, but the rest of their body was unburned. Now, if you caught in a fire, if you caught in a fire that's going to kill you, it wouldn't just affect your legs or your arms. It would probably affect your whole body.
There was also fire suppression chemicals, like with a fire extinguisher, evidence in one instance where the body had been dragged from one place to another. And, you know, through this fire extinguisher residue, you know, this was not a building on fire. This was a staged event that was a mass murder of the most hideous kind.
And there's been no accountability at all for what happened. The Kiev government did its own quote-unquote investigation, which of course means an utter whitewash, and that's exactly what happened. And supposedly an investigation was conducted on the Maidan, the Independent Square killings, that really got this whole business right before the coup last February, getting rid of the President Yanukovych and putting elevating fascists into power. And there were 100-odd people killed, mostly Berkut police, shot by these fascists from windows or building tops overlooking the square. And again, the Kiev government did what they called an investigation and whitewashed the whole thing, blamed Yanukovych for the killings, and of course he had nothing whatsoever to do with them.
This leads maybe to the MH17 incident.
Oh, another cover-up.
You know, there was the Russian request for a response from the Ukrainian government to the 10 questions that the Russian Defense Ministry posed regarding the crash of MH17. As with, for instance, could the Kiev government give all details related to the use of book systems in the combat zone, and especially answer why these systems were deployed, given that the militias have no aircraft. What are the reasons for the inaction of the Ukrainian authorities on forming an international commission, and when will such a commission start to function? The international community wants to know, the Defense Ministry wants to know. And a list of these very sort of basic, obvious questions, including the release of air traffic control data, will not be made released. From a sort of qui bono analysis, who benefits from that incident? It's so obviously the finger's point towards U.S.-backed authorities. So obviously, the Russians had absolutely nothing to gain, nothing, by any scenario of the shootdown, even if it was, and if it was accidental, where was the means to do it? It's And then the bizarre claims and evidence, you know, as with the crash site, claims made that some bodies appeared obviously to have been dead for a long time, right, at the crash site, drained of all blood. Some evidence that mannequins were in the mix, you know, and who gained access to that crash site. Dutch authorities claiming at some point that they ought to have sovereign rights to that geography because it was their national interest to be given those rights, you know, sort of to go in, secure the perimeter, as it were, in a foreign country, with a kind of, you know, sort of miniature occupation. You know, it would seem to obscure what, you know, to mess with whatever material evidence there was.
Oh, indeed, Matt. We've got a couple of minutes left. Any important points you want to make, let's bring them out now. But there's no question that Russia had nothing to do with bringing down their plane, nor the self-defense forces in Donetsk or Lugansk. They had nothing to do with it. And the most important question never gets asked. Key Bono, obviously there's nothing, as you said, there is no benefit whatever Russia could have by bringing down the plane. It was a Ukrainian jet aircraft warplane trailing the commercial airliner, shooting it down with cannon fire, and that's what brought it down. But there's a big cover-up and a whitewash, so the mainstream media will never tell the truth.
There was another piece in that component that came in, Royal Dutch Shell facing a huge financial liability for oil extraction and contracts that they very much wanted to get out of that were in the vicinity of the crash site. And instead, the correspondence of that vote is to just what was being done. I can't recall the details at this point. But
was that a fracking issue that they wanted to do fracking in that area?
I'm not sure that it was fracking or whether it was natural gas, but they faced a loss of billions. Of dollars in sort of failure to comply with contracts that they desperately wanted to get out of, and the Downing incident would play into this in some particular ways that now I'm sorry the details are escaping me, but this is a very important feature to be examining when these incidents of murky provenance occur, including MH370, the preposterously mysterious disappearance of MH370, and the speculation that, you know, the interest in that case had to do with patent rights that would implicate the Rothschild. Particular, I can't recall exactly what the patent was for, but that there's a plausible connection to be made.
Matt, we are out of time.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
The clock is our master. I look forward to getting you back. The horrors that go on in our name, Matt, it's important for programs like this, others on PRN and other independent media, to point this out and explain to people how we're being abused by our government. We're the victims of government criminality. It's a shame, and that's exactly what goes on. Matt, I look forward to having you back to keep discussing these big issues.
Likewise, Stephen. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, bye-bye.